Dave Van Ronk, Sunday Street, from his most recent recording on Philo Records, but it won't be his most recent record in about a couple of weeks when a brand new record comes out on Philo. Unfortunately, it's not coming out till a couple of weeks, so we won't be able to play that for you this afternoon. Well, Dave Van Ronk's playing and singing has introduced many listeners to blues and jug band music. Listeners started becoming aware of him in the 1960s, I guess. Styles and fads have come and gone since that time. His style has remained his own. He took a few years off from performing, but he's returned to the scene a few years ago. The most recent album is the one we heard. Again, a new one's on its way out in about a week or two. He's in Philadelphia to perform at the Main Point, and any more information about his concert this evening can be gotten by calling the Main Point at 525-3375. If you'd like any further ticket information. Dave Van Ronk, it's a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you
right now for coming to Fresh Air. Do you feel like there's much of a folk music scene now?
Yeah, it really is. It's not as public as it was in the 60s. I'd say that there's a much greater base of people who know traditional music than there was during the folk revival in the 60s, what Bruce Phillips calls the Great Folk Scare. Because people were listening to folk music in the 1960s, and they were listening to it not necessarily because they liked it, but because it was popular. And since that time, I think there are more informed listeners all over the place, and people who, what is more important from my point of view, people who can actually play it and do it, sing it well. Yeah, any town you go to, you know, you're in Eastover Shoe, Montana, and there's going to be some banjoist or guitarist that's 18 years old who'll knock your socks off. You know? it's a far cry from 1968.
Now, folk music is a kind of music that frequently symbolizes something to its listeners. It can symbolize purity or a return to history, an understanding of a certain culture. Have you been through that, watching people for whom your music or other forms of folk music symbolizes something above and beyond the music itself?
Music always does. Music always does, even the most apparently functionless music. Will have, there is a sociological statement inherent in a string quartet. To go to the opera is a statement about your perception of your class and your status and so on and so on. Folk music also is a statement of your perceptions of your class, caste, status, all of that sort of thing, too. Generally, not always, but generally it's linked with sentiments akin to those of the left. But there's also the roots phenomenon, too. A lot of things.
Do you think that any of that symbolism is different now in the early 1980s than it was, say, during the 1960s?
Oh, sure. I mean, you had the civil rights movement, you had the anti-war movement. In the 1930s, there was a big folk revival, and there you had the CIO, the Depression, all that sort of thing. Usually when folk music becomes popular, it becomes popular as an adjunct to some kind of a mass movement that also is reflected in politics.
What did it mean to you when you started discovering the music that has been very important to you? Blues musicians, jazz musicians, people like John Hurt or Jelly Roll Morton. What was that discovery like for you, and what did it open up for you? And did it symbolize anything?
Well, I don't think, it certainly had nothing to do with my politics at that point. I mean, I've been only too happy to lend my talents to this, that, or the other cause. But to me, I started out as a jazz musician, and I was interested in jazz as an improvisational form of musical expression, et cetera, et cetera. I get, a long list of boring definitions and that sort of thing, but I fancied myself a very, very smart young fella. And gradually I got more and more interested in country blues coming from a jazz background. It took a little, I had to overcome a kind of a jazz musician snobbery about traditional music to begin with.
What was the nature of that snobbery?
Well, they only play three chords and I get two of them wrong, you know, that kind of thing, you know. And I still like to get my chords right. I still wince when I miss a cycle of fifths or a relative minor. There's a diminished chord that should be in there that ain't. It still bothers me.
You've seen a lot of, I guess, fads come and go in folk music. Are there any types of approaches or types of groups that you're glad have gone?
Well, you get overexposed to anything, and you, as a rule, you're glad to see it go. Now, I can't really single out any particular fad that I'm glad to have seen the last of. I'm glad to have seen the last of any of them. I don't like that kind of sudden hype, saturation, and so on. So there's a quality to the whole phenomenon that just turns me off.
Has anyone ever asked of you that you become someone else or play in another style?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Record producers?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What were some of those requests?
Well, how about getting together a rock and roll band? There's really good money in it, they said. Well, like Oscar Wilde said, I can resist anything but temptation. I did it. Failed horribly. Died the death of a thousand cuts. Couldn't do it right. Made a good record. But doing it in the studio and doing it on stage, really two different things. And what I'm doing now is what I do best on stage.
Well, you've played with other bands. Were those through your own initiation or through other people's encouragement?
Well, I've done studio sessions and things like that. And it was the Jug Band, and that wasn't a deviation for the sake of getting more commercial, I assure you. Also, I had trouble there too for the same reason. I just, I remember a report card that I got once when I was in grammar school. It says, "Does not work and play well with others." Some things never change.
Do a lot of your listeners come up to you and want to hear all about the 1960s in Greenwich Village and what the scene was like then?
Oh, yeah, I get a lot of that.
I wonder what that's like for you, because I know, I would guess that when you were coming of age, you were wondering what it was like in maybe New Orleans in the 1920s or Kansas City in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. There's something very magical about periods that you didn't live through where the music that you really care about was formed. And now you can talk firsthand about a period that has great magic to your listeners.
You know, it's a funny thing. I was aware of that when I was working on McDougal Street in the early of the mid-60s. I knew that this is one of those scenes that I'm going to write about. I wasn't the only one who knew it. I think a lot of us who were working there had that sense of, some kind of musical history, that this is one of those scenes like Storyville in New Orleans or 52nd Street in the 1930s, something like that. All right, now that being said, you would have thought that I or someone who noticed it would have taken copious notes. A musical diary at the very least, who was playing, what they were doing, who threw a drink in whose face at which bar, the usual thing. Who ran off with whose husband? Nope, I never did. And I have a memory like a sieve. I'm told we had a very good time.
Well, and I've always really wondered about this, about those people who write wonderful memoirs where they know who threw what kind of drink. They could even tell you what was in the glass, how many ice cubes were in it. Mm-hmm. And I just can't imagine. I guess maybe some people do keep diaries. Do you feel bad about that? That you don't have a very precise memory
sometimes,
of the period?
Sometimes it really bothers me. Yeah, there's a good book in it somewhere. Somebody should write it.
Well, you live where, in the West Village now?
Mm-hmm.
How has, I know it's changed a lot, but how has the area changed as far as you're concerned?
Streets are more crowded. When I was working down on McDougal Street, you couldn't get much more crowded than that on weekends. They'd have to close it to automobiles. It was that crowded. And McDougal and Bleecker were like that every weekend during the summer from 1961 until about 1964, 65. But once you got off those two streets and the immediate streets leading to them from subways, things were fairly quiet. Now, the streets, almost anywhere you go in the village, are absolutely jam-packed. Not as packed as McDougal Street was. Cars still can get through. And concomitant with that, more and more shops have opened up to service the tourists. And as a result, I find it very annoying. You know, a little shoemaker shop around the corner closes down and becomes a falafel stand. The falafel stand goes out of business in 2 or 3 years, but forget a new shoe repair store. That's not going to come back in. So all kinds of really utilitarian shops being forced down, the rents have just gone up astronomically. It's in order to pay your rent, if you're you know, running a shoe repair store, you have to charge $200 a shoe or something. That is just astronomical what the landlords are gouging around there. Another thing, and very conspicuous, is, you have more screaming crazies out on the streets. And this is because, I think, because they've emptied the mental hospitals to save money. Now, of course, they say that they're doing it because they don't want to interfere with the lunatics' civil rights if they're harmless. But basically, it's because they don't want to take care of them.
Have you ever been part of a citizens group or residents group within the West Village to prevent spreading tourist traps or more and more falafel stands?
No. No. You can't do that. The life of any area in any city is an organic matter. You can't tamper with it that way. I mean, what's happening in the village? This too shall pass. I remember once predicting that I would be around to see grass growing on the street on McDougal Street, and by God, free, it has almost happened.
Well, I want to play another selection from your newest record. We're going to be hearing you playing something written by Jelly Roll Morton called "Pearls." Now, can you just say a few words about this before we hear it?
Yeah, this is the most difficult guitar piece I've ever attempted on record. I don't perform it live anymore because it's something you have to practice an hour or two a day for 3 or 4 days just to have it in, you know, barely into performing shape. I've wanted to play it ever since I first heard the Jelly Roll Morton recording of it. I couldn't get it from his piano recording, though. I had to use the recording he did with his small band, the Red Hot Peppers, because Morton kept on throwing in embellishments when he'd be playing the piano. You'd never get it straight. But he made the man in the Red Hot Peppers read the notes.
I understand he used to write out improvisations for his band members.
Yes. Yes, he would do that. It would depend on for whom. He would, I believe, do it for George Ori, for Kid Ori.
Before we hear your version of this, can you just tell us a little bit about what...
Edward Ori, sorry.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you had to do to take his piece and make it sensible on guitar? Sensible to play and to listen to?
Well, it's kind of technical. The first thing I had to do is I had to change the key. It was in A-flat. I changed it to A major because A-flat is a practically impossible key on the guitar, especially in first position. And there were a whole series of you know, rotten compromises that I had to make between what was available, reachable on the guitar, and what Morton had actually intended. But I think I have as close a rendering of the piece as Morton did himself on piano. That is to say, he took a lot of liberties with his own score, too, so why shouldn't I?
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Dave Van Ronk's recording of The Pearls.
Thank you.
Dave Van Ronk's recording of Jelly Roll Morton's The Pearls. Now, I think of what we just heard as probably coming pretty magically to you. You just sit down, figure it out, and play it. What was it like to work it up?
That was some of the hardest work I've ever done in my life, and I've done some pretty hard work. I'd rather be in the hold of a tanker mucking out the decks in an acetone tank than have to go through that again. It was 8 hours a day for 2 or 3 weeks with innumerable long pauses with it. Just be these blocks. I simply couldn't figure out a way to get the notes or even an approximation of the notes as originally scored. And hunting all over the damn guitar trying to find a fingering that would give me this, that, and the other thing. Very frustrating any number of times. You just want to throw the damn thing across the room and, pick up your ukulele and play Yes Sir, That's My Baby.
One of the things I find really interesting about this is that the stereotype of folk music and folk musicians is that, hey, anyone can do it. You get in the spirit, you sing along, pick up a guitar, 4 chords, and you're all set. And now, you do some spirituals and traditional music that maybe has 4 chords in it, and you can just strum along and sing a simple melody. But what keeps you determined enough to do this other end of music where it takes that kind of figuring out and mental concentration and physical prowess to really get it done, get it under your fingers and figure out where to put the notes?
Well, I don't really know. It's something that it's something that I do for myself, but I also do it to show off. I enjoy the challenge for all the complaining I do about it, and I like the feeling once I've got a certain section of it that's been very recalcitrant. I've got it down. The important thing, though, is that is the individual piece of music, and whatever technical ability that the piece demands, that's what you simply have to acquire. If you want the piece badly enough, you'll do it. I mean, given a cattle prod, a lousy guitar player, an infinity of time, I could teach anyone to play that. But you've got to really want to do that particular tune. Now, I've been listening to that tune ever since I was 12 or 13. I always wanted to play it. And I never did learn to play the piano, so I was stuck with the guitar.
That's a tough instrument to play, that arm.
Well, it has its compensations. It's not exactly as if you're playing a Schubert quintet on kazoos. It sounds nice. It has a very nice parlor sound I like.
Have you noticed lately that there's a lot of advertisements that are using one form or another of folk music?
Well, this has been going on since the 60s. I remember when Glenn Yarborough was, I think he was the first Friendly Skies of United. That was around 64 or something like that, 65. I remember Bob Gibson, the Vermont-made, the Vermont-made troubadour was Bob Gibson. He had a lot of trouble living that one down. When Gainsburgers or someone like that picked up the rights to Tom Paxton's My Dog's Bigger Than Your Dog, you remember that? They still, in the background, you'll hear still da 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 da. You know. So there is no new thing under the sun. So there's a little, there's a minor wave of that. The tsunami is behind us.
Are you amused or angered by that?
Amused more than anything else. What the hell? Somebody's going to make the money. Why shouldn't it be one of us?
What are some of the things that you like and don't like when you're playing in a club in terms of the response that you'll get or the requests that you'll get?
Well, I like standing ovations. I like being carried off the stage by adulatory fans upon their shoulders. Large denomination bills flying around me and so on. But short of that, I will settle for an audience that has some idea of what it is that I'm doing. It embarrasses me no end to have people think that I wrote the Cocaine Blues or something like that. It's, you know, I'm not mad at anyone who does think that way, but it embarrasses me because it, in not knowing Reverend Gary Davis's version of it and so on, and having no basis for comparison, I don't think people can see what I'm doing with it.
Well, you've
not
always,
as well, anyway.
You've always been very obvious with your credits to other people and your records. And
that is to encourage people to go and listen to the others. You know, I really, you know, I want to see a more and more and more enlightened audience.
When
it
you're
makes it more fun for me.
Mm-hmm. When you're asked to sing Cocaine, will you sing it?
Sometimes. I like it. It's one of the old ones that I've been doing, I guess, for 20 years now or more, that I've never gotten tired of. Because it's a nice, loose arrangement. And you can phrase it differently each time, or you know. Of course, one always has one standard fallback phrasing. If you're not feeling especially inspired, you better have a minimal fallback position so you can do it well.
What are some of the tunes or composers that you've recently added to your repertoire?
Oh, I just added a new guitar rag. I have the Entertainer, which I've wanted to play for years. Ever since I was a kid, when I first heard it, I guess I was about 12, on the piano. And I was teaching guitar for a while, up until a couple of years ago. And when The Sting came out, everybody heard, you know, that piece. And it was a great deal of pressure on me from students, since I was teaching other classic rags, other Joplin pieces, to do that. And so I worked it up, but the piece was so all-pervasive, you couldn't walk down the streets without having it blared at you, that I didn't perform it until just recently. I didn't even bother to try to get it into performing shape until the last, you know, 6 months, year, whatever it is.
Yeah, I remember I had a teacher in college who said that the only time he'd read a bestseller is like 4 years after it had been a bestseller, because he figured if it was still worth reading then, it was probably worth reading in the first place.
Yeah, well, I just don't like to get on the stage and make like a jukebox.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that's what people pay to hear me to do, you know.
Have you ever had any run-ins with folk purists?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, you know, there's a certain variety of folk purist that I see very, very little of, and I've heard stories. But in my field, a blues singer is allowed, within the canons of the field, there's allowed a great deal of elbow room. You can do a lot without annoying. It takes an awful lot to get a blues fanatic's goat. I know, I've tried. One time I worked out an arrangement, sort of like the guitar arrangement of Hoochie Coochie Man. Da 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 da, boom, boom, that sort of thing. Da 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 da, hail to thee, blithe spirit. Ba 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 ba, bird thou never word. Ba 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 ba, didn't annoy anyone. And if that ain't going to get him, nothing's going to get him. So my audiences are pretty loose.
If we go to your concert this evening, what can we expect to hear?
Well, I don't think I'll do Ode to a Skylark tonight.
Shucks.
I don't know. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I want to do this afternoon is go over my repertoire and insert some things and extract some others from the things that I've been doing over the last 6 or 8 months. And I haven't decided how it's going to come up. I'll be doing some of the new things that I'm doing. I hope I'll be, I'll probably be doing The Entertainer. I'll probably, the title song for the new album, which is Somebody Else, Not Me. It's an old Burt Williams tune. And I'm working madly on putting the finishing touches on an arrangement to a tune that I just finished writing, but I don't know if that's going to be ready, so I won't say anything.
Okay. Dave Van Ronk, it's been a treat to have you here. Thank you so much for coming to Fresh Air. And Dave Van Ronk will be performing at the Main Point this evening on Lancaster Avenue. And for ticket information, you can call the Main Point at 525-3375. And go through that again. That's 525-3375. Now, I'd like to just play a couple of tunes before Bill Van Wert joins us, our film reviewer, and he'll be reviewing the film Airplane today. We're going to hear something old and something new. From Dave Van Ronk, and the first thing is from one of his jug band records. Now, this is, we're going to hear Mac the Knife, and I'm told that you are actually very, very interested in the music of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht, and before we hear this, just like to ask you a little bit about that interest.
Well, I like the music. I think one of the reasons why I like the music, the setting so much, is because in the 1920s, Kurt Weill was very, very impressed with American jazz. One can hear Ellington all throughout Weill's orchestrations and things like that from that period. And another reason is I like Brecht's lyrics because they say exactly what they mean. They are tough and they are unsentimental, and There is a tensile quality that comes through in English. He wrote, of course, mostly in German. Not entirely. Alabama song he wrote in English. He wrote at least two songs in English before he learned the language. He used a tourist German-English phrase book for O Moon of Alabama.
Oh, how interesting.
Uh-huh. And there are some beautiful grammatical goofs in the Benares song, also from Mahogany, the same opera. Where is the telephone? Is here no telephone? Beautiful. But mostly he wrote in German, and the strength comes through very, very clearly into English. The two languages are similar enough, so that a translation, it's not... I think it would probably be more difficult to translate Brecht into a Romance language than into another Teutonic language. So that's it. I like the words. I like the music. Sometimes I agree with the sentiments.
Okay. Well, let's hear this recording of Mac the Knife, and this is from Dave Van Ronk with a jug band, and then we'll hear another selection from his recent album. Thank you again for being here.
Thank you.
Shark has pretty teeth here, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has McKeith here, and he keeps it out of sight. When the shark bites with his teeth, dear, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's McKeith, dear? So there's not a trace of red on a side. Body once in life, someone sneaking round the corner. Is that someone? Thank you.
Or would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a fish? A fish is an animal that swims in a brook. Can't write a poem or read a book. To fool the people is his only thought. But though he's slippery, he still gets caught. And by the way, if you don't clean up your dish, you may grow up to be a fish. How would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a mule? A mule is an animal with long funny ears, kicks up at everything he hears. His back is brawny and his brain is weak. He's just plain stupid with a stubborn streak. And by the way, if you hate to go to school, you may grow up to be a mule. How would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar. I'd be better off than you are. Or would you rather be a pig? A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace. He's sloppy and he's dirty and he's grungy up front. When he talks, all he does is grunt. And if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig. And all the monkeys ain't in the zoo. Every day you'll see quite a few. So you see, it's all up to you. You could be better than you are. You could be swinging on a star. Hey. You could be swinging on a star. Hey. You could be swinging on a star. Hey.